Our next guest on Downtown has written a number of terrific books on the subject of baseball, including Sandy Koufax, A Lefty's Legacy, and The Last Boy, her biography of Mickey Mantle. Her latest book is a study of Babe Ruth, but, well, it's more than just a biography of Babe. The book is called The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. We're thrilled to be joined by Jane Levy this afternoon. And Jane, this book, I like all your books, about more than just baseball. This one really chronicles, in many ways, the rise of modern celebrity.
You know, when the book was published and it first appeared on Amazon, my editor called me triumphantly to say, "Janie, you're a historian. They've listed you under history books, not as well as sports." And I was thrilled because I was so terrified to take what I perceived as a very large and precarious step into writing about history as well as, you know, just the facts and figures about batting and throwing and hitting. And so I'm grateful that you said that, because that was what I was aiming to do.
Well, and it really was, in many ways, particularly the year that the book centers around, 1927, it was the age of celebrity, with Valentino, Charles Lindbergh, and these larger-than-life characters seemingly everywhere you looked, but none bigger than the Babe.
Yeah, I'd put him on Mount Rushmore of fame in 1927. What I wanted to do, Rich, to be serious for one second, is give people feeling of what it was to be Babe Ruth at the apogee of fame, at the exact moment in history when fame was being reinvented by technology, by marketing, by public relations. And I wanted also people to feel what it was like to be around him, because unlike today's, you know, mega stars, who of course still, you know, are whatever they might like to say, are still infinitesimal compared to his shadow, the shadow he cast. He was so accessible. I mean, that's the only thing that's not modern about him. You know, you look at the picture that we used on the what's called the end papers for the book, meaning the inside the cover, and we used this picture of him taken in Syracuse in 1925 when 5,000 boys, you know, careened out of a bandbox ballpark to try to cram themselves into a single frame with Babe Ruth. And if you look at it, they're as euphoric as he is. They're draped all over him. I mean, one kid's got his arm, you know, kind of wrapped around Babe's neck like a cheap boa. And, you know, feature that today. Can you imagine, you know, Aaron Judge allowing people to climb on him like that? I mean, there'd be bodyguards out there to escort him off the field. But Babe Ruth loved it. He needed it. It completed him. And so that was why he was the perfect person to be this first model of modern celebrity, because he welcomed it so much.
Well, now, of course, today, where we scrutinize every detail of an athlete's personal life, Ruth was very much a flawed hero, but in some ways, did that make him the right hero for his time?
Well, you know, it's people didn't really know quite how flawed he was. That was part of the difference. You know, one of the other things that was being created then was the tabloid culture that, you know, would take advantage of popular culture and augment it. The first newspaper that was, you know, the first tabloid in America was the Daily News, which went to press for the first time in June 1919 and invented the back page in November 1919. And while it wasn't deliberately created for Babe Ruth, he occupied it for the first time when, after the sale to New York on January 6, 1920, and would fill it up after that. So, you know, sports writing in those days was a very different kind of animal. For one thing, they didn't actually go down and interview athletes. Nobody went down to the locker room to get quotes. But the irony is they knew these guys. They wouldn't go down to the locker room and ask a question, but they would go to Babe Ruth's apartment for dinner. And it would all be off the record because there was this clubhouse omerta. You know, you just didn't write about personal things. And so as a result of that, the athletes, and particularly Babe Ruth, felt comfortable really being themselves. So these guys knew far more about the people they covered than they wrote. And that changed, or began to change. There's a whole thing in the book about when Captain Joe Patterson, the publisher of the Daily News, decided in August 1925 to abandon the customary, speak no evil, hear no evil, and published a picture of Babe Ruth's mistress and on the front page of the Daily News. And that picture, because technology had just been invented that allowed for it, was sent overnight by a system invented by the Chicago Tribune called Telepix. It was sent overnight to Chicago and to Los Angeles. And while it was a prototype of the AP wire photo service that would not come into use until the 30s and widespread use, and it was very expensive, you could nonetheless do it in 1925. And you did it for things that were really important, like Babe Ruth's 60th home run in 27, and like the revelation that he was living with another woman in 1925 when he was suspended and fined back $5,000 by the Yankees for showing up late to a game in St. Louis.
We're talking with Jane Levy, author of the wonderful book of the big fella, Babe Ruth, and the world he created. The other larger-than-life figure in this book is Christy Walsh, who was a little bit Scott Boras and a whole lot of P.T. Barnum, and really reinvented the way we look at athletes.
Yeah, you know, he was sort of lost to history, and that's always fun when you can excavate somebody from, anonymity. Walsh was really the prototype for Jerry Maguire, and though he didn't, say the words, "show me the money," that was, in fact, what he was doing in the 20s for Babe Ruth. Their relationship started as one for a one-year contract where Christy Walsh got him to agree to allow Walsh to syndicate ghostwritten stories under his name, and it grew into a relationship where Walsh had complete control of all his finances, and he did for Babe Ruth everything that a Lee Steinberg or a Casey Close or a Scott Boras does today, with the exception that he could not actually negotiate directly with the Yankees. That was verboten and would remain verboten, much to the owner's great pleasure and advantage, until Marvin Miller came along in the 1960s.
I think one of the most interesting stories in the book is the battle that raged on between Babe Ruth and Christy Walsh and the Curtis Candy Company, the folks who created the Baby Ruth bar, who then claimed, oh, it had nothing to do with Babe Ruth. It's Grover Cleveland's daughter, who had been dead 15 years when the candy bar was introduced.
Yeah, I love that story, and I'm glad you mentioned it, because some people are like, what is she doing going off into, you know, legal stuff? And the thing that she was doing was trying to show that what Babe Ruth and Christy Walsh were doing in monetizing his celebrity and in treating him and marketing him as an entertainer, not just as a guy who hit balls out of ballparks, was so radically different that the law couldn't catch up with him and didn't catch up with him until 1951, when the right of publicity finally became a part of the legal canon. But when Curtis Candy decided in 1919 to rename a failing candy bar, the candy cake, to name it the Baby Ruth, there was no legal recourse for Babe Ruth to sue and say, wait a minute, you're capitalizing on my name and likeness. So Curtis could get away with this cockamamie story, as you mentioned, that it was really in honor of Grover Cleveland's dead daughter, baby Ruth Cleveland, who I think had died in 1904.
Well, we've heard a lot through the years about Babe Ruth's young life and the St. Mary's Industrial School, and a lot of that, as you point out in the book, comes from a fairly, well, I guess for lack of a better word, embellished, fictitious version by the legendary Westbrook Pegler. The real childhood of Babe Ruth was very different than people were led to believe.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that, you know, people ask me all the time, what most surprised you? And there's two things. One is how bad it really was, how Dickensian it was, and that it was kept quiet for, you know, for this long. You know, plenty of other biographers tried to get at this yawning gap in his biography that I was able to fill. And the only reason I was able to do it that they couldn't was because of the recent availability of digitized family documents housed in state archives and of newspapers that are either long defunct or even if they're still publishing today, where you'd have to have read in microfilm, you know, a year's worth of newsprint to find what I could find with a click of the mouse. So the point about the childhood of a little boy that his family called Little George is that he was a product of the term of art is a broken home, but it wasn't just a broken home. This was a demolished home. His parents were divorced, and the divorce was made public in the papers of Baltimore and the Baltimore Sun and Baltimore American, and the grounds that it was granted on were made public. And those were George Ruth Sr. charged his wife with adultery and drunkenness and was awarded custody of the three surviving children of that marriage in May 1906. And the consequence for Babe Ruth, who had been first sent off to St. Mary's Industrial School for Boys on June 13, 1902, was that his fate was sealed. His father had neither the time nor the interest to raise this kid. And so in the absence of fact, since those papers and documents were hidden for so long, mythology filled in this void. And one myth was that he was an orphan. And he would protest that. I mean, reporters would come to him and say, "So you're an orphan and you were raised in an orphanage." "No, I had parents," he would say. But he never went further. And why would he? Who would want to advertise, you know, the truly ugly facts of his parents' divorce? Who would want to advertise, and if he even knew it, that two of the four siblings that died while he was still a little boy died of starvation? So by the time he's sent off to St. Mary's, when he's 7 years old, you know, he's witnessed the death of four siblings. And despite that, they still don't want him. You know, there's only two kids left, and they still don't want him. So understanding what happened to the little boy was key to understanding how and why he became the big fella. Like, he needed to be that larger-than-life character who was surrounded by thousands of boys in God knows how many ballparks. They filled in a gap that was missing in his childhood. And it was also very familiar to him, because after all, at St. Mary's, he was raised in a dorm with, you know, 130 kids sleeping head to toe on one floor of one dorm. So he knew how to be public. What he didn't know how to be was alone. And his second wife, Claire, would tell family members that he just couldn't stand to be alone.
And it certainly helps understand the appetites that he had for all things, all the pleasures that he didn't experience as a young boy in the streets of Baltimore.
Yeah, one of the key things that his daughter, Julia Ruth Stevens, who is alive at 102, told me was that the only thing he ever said to her about his time at St. Mary's was this: I never felt full. And that is both a statement of actual hunger, because the brothers who ran the school were perpetually behind in on their bills. They were constantly in debt and struggling to care for the number of kids that were sent to them. And they had something like six cents a kid to feed them. But it was also, I think, a statement of how hungry he was for love and attention of a family that he never got. And so, yeah, he filled himself up for the rest of his life once he was out of there with women and with food and with cigars and certainly with beer. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you know, these kids get meat once a week. And what did they get? Hot dogs. Is it any wonder that he gorged himself on hot dogs?
He was also dogged throughout his young life and even into his professional career with rumors about his lineage and some pretty racist comments about his appearance and whether or not he might be African-American. Did that help him along the way have a better understanding and even identify a bit with people of color who were going through their own struggles?
You know, Rich, I wish I had been able to find, you know, a written statement or an article or something which quoted him on that. I couldn't. You know, the only time he ever confronted those rumors was in the 1922 World Series. The very, very racist name that was given to him on the playgrounds of St. Mary's, which is based purely on stereotypical ideas of African-American appearance, like a big wide nose and thick lips. That name followed him into the major league.
Right.
And, you know, as you know, dugouts are no places for sissies. And so people will yell and scream anything they think will distract you from your business at home plate. And so a lot of racist things throughout his career, including during this World Series, where a guy named Johnny Rawlings, who was at that point a scrub for the New York Giants, you know, was screaming epithets at him throughout the series. And finally, after a particularly bad game, he got fed up. And of course, as you know, the Yankees were still sharing the Polo Grounds with the Giants there last year there. And he goes over into the Giants locker room, a breach of etiquette, and picks this guy up by scruff of his neck and says, "You can call me a blank and you can call me a blank blank, but don't get personal." And then he notices that there are all these reporters standing there. And he begs these guys, the beat writers, not to write what had transpired. And they agreed. They didn't write it. And so that part of his response to the rumors about his ethnicity did not become public till Frank Graham wrote it in his History of the Yankees in the 1940s.
We're talking with Jane Levy about her book, The Big Fella, Babe Ruth and the World He Created. One of the things I love about this book, because there have been a number of books written about Ruth before, but the structure that you use and centering it around this barnstorming tour when he reached the height of popularity, I thought was a wonderful way to tell the story and really help put us as readers into his life and look at the world through the eyes of Babe.
Thank you for saying that, because the people who don't like the book don't like it because it is not linear. And I felt, you know, that so many really good books had been written already, you know, chief among them Bob Cremer's book, and most recently Lee Montfield's book, that were, you know, soup to nuts traditional biographies. And I didn't think there was any percentage in trying to improve on those. And so, as I said, I wanted, you know, he's king of the world in October 1927. He's just hit his 60th home run, circling the bases, crowing, 60, count him, 60. Let's see some other son of a bitch do that. And then he leads the Yankees to a sweep of the Pirates. and he hits the only two home runs in that World Series. And then he and Lou Gehrig, who was, of course, the MVP that year, in large measure because you couldn't be named MVP twice under the under those rules.
Right.
He and Gehrig and Christy Walsh take off on what amounted to a victory tour of America, taking, you know, the show on the road to places that had never seen Major League Baseball players. And, you know, it is so typical of Major League Baseball that back then they didn't see what Babe Ruth knew, that he was creating a market and showing that there was an appetite for Major League Baseball in places where it wasn't played and where it was just beginning to be heard on radio.
Is he, in many ways, the antithesis of your earlier subjects, Sandy Koufax, who was such a private person, and then Mickey Mantle, who grew very weary of his celebrity as time went on?
I don't really think so. I mean, I think there's a way in which the books are actually very connected, but I didn't see it, frankly, until it was over. In some ways, they're all about celebrity, and Koufax was a guy who eschewed it, who knew himself well enough and knew what the world was like enough to realize that the kind of celebrity in the modern era, and this was before, you know, cell phone cameras and Twitter feeds, is corrosive of a person's sense of self, and it can eat your soul. And he's enough of a person, a whole person, as they say in Yiddish, that he didn't want any part of that. I mean, as a player, you know, he always answered questions. He never hid in locker rooms. He always answered the questions, but the questions weren't the ones that are asked today. And you know, I think that we've lost a sense of what the difference is between being reclusive and being and having a sense of privacy in the old fashioned way, a sense of the word. So that was Koufax. Mantle, I think, was destroyed by celebrity, because here's this 19-year-old kid who comes to New York off the, the plains of Oklahoma, where his father would, you know, work in the lead and zinc mines and die from a disease that killed so many of those miners. And he was completely unprepared for New York cafe society. And he was completely a sitting duck for everyone who wanted to buy the Mick a drink, not knowing that alcoholism ran deep in his family and that they were, in essence, helping to kill him. And Ruth is the guy who created celebrity. Yes, I think he had more of a personality for it than the other two. But they're not completely opposites. They're just, you know, they're reflective of the times in which they played and their upbringing.
Well, Jane, times have changed so much in the last 90 years. Do you think we'll ever see a celebrity the size and with the reach and the scope of a Babe Ruth again?
I think it's, you know, the media, as we like to call it, is so fractured. It appears in so many different ways. And the marketing is so much bigger. Yeah, there'll probably be somebody, but it's probably not going to be a baseball player. It's the nature of human beings that we evolve, and that somebody takes as a challenge what, you know, the best before them could do, and say, I'm going to do it better. I'm going to do it different. I'm going to exceed them. So, yeah, somebody's going to come around who will amaze us. But I think the attention is so fragmented and the attention span is so small that it will be hard for anybody to dominate the headlines and the attention of the country the way Babe Ruth did.
I absolutely love the book, The Big Fella. I've read a lot about Ruth over the years, but I feel like I know him better after reading this book than any of the others I've read. Jane, it's a great pleasure for us to talk with you. Thank you for making time for us.
Rich, do you have time for one more story?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, always.
Okay, cool. You know, even back in Ruth's day, you know, there was cynicism. And so people thought and snickered behind his back that all the stuff he did for kids, all the hospital visits and things, were just for show or for PR. Now, it is true that Christy Walsh, his agent, was a really smart guy, and he understood that pictures of Ruth eating a gigantic turkey leg at Thanksgiving, for example, would go a long way to countering the next bad story of him, you know, running amok or getting fined or suspended by Miller Huggins or whatever it was. So, yeah, Christy Walsh was certainly going to use that stuff. But I think his affinity for children was absolutely real. And even in his dying days, literally the last days of his life, he was still on the road working for the Ford Motor Company, which was the only company that would pay him to do anything. He was so sick that they would hire nurses to go with him on his train trips. And that last summer of 48, he went to St. Louis to Sportsman's Park, where there were 10,000 kids who were supposed to have a clinic, a baseball clinic with Babe Ruth. Of course, he was so weak he could barely hold a bat. And the one kid who was designated to be photographed with him and, you know, learn these tips from him was the son of the owner of the Browns, Billy DeWitt Jr., who is now known as Senior, but that's complicated, but if you get the point. And he wore, actually, his uniform later was used by Eddie Goodell in his famous at-bat for the Browns. But after that, Babe Ruth went to Minnesota and to Minneapolis. And by this point, he was just really on his last legs. But he agrees to do a radio interview. And what's significant to me about that is think about when his career began, 1914, when fame and the world's knowledge of you was as big only and circumscribed by the circulation of a daily newspaper. There was no radio in 1914, right? And here he is at the end of his life, sitting with a little boy in his lap. His little boy's name was Johnny Ross, and Johnny was blind, and Babe could hardly talk. The cancer that would kill him within the next month or so, which was nasopharyngeal cancer, had surrounded the carotid artery and was pressed on the nerve by his eye, causing his eye to droop, and he was in a lot of pain, and he could barely talk. So Johnny is going to interview him. And he asks him who he thinks is going to win the pennant, and Babe gives some answer, and he asks him about his autobiography, which had just been published, which he had very little to do with because he was too sick, really, to talk or to contribute. And then the kid asks him how he feels, and he says, oh, my throat is really hurting, and I've got a, you know, my headache, something awful. And the kid gets quiet, and Babe gets quiet, and he puts his arm around this little boy and says, it's okay, Johnny. I think we're both out of words.
Mm. Yeah, the last couple of chapters in the epilogue of the book, just heartbreaking. Him refereeing wrestling matches, going off to work with William Bendix on the film to try and teach him how to swing a bat. And it's such a sad ending for a guy, but he seemed to maintain that that positive and in some ways that childlike attitude right till the end.
Well, that's what he knew how to do. What he knew how to do was to be Babe Ruth. And what baseball did by virtue of never finding a place for him in the game after he retired in June 1935, having played three awful months for the Boston Braves and being disappointed by, you know, in the promises that weren't kept by the owner, Judge Fuchs. You know, the last 13 years of his life, even before the cancer, were, I think, excruciating because it was exactly the same kind of abandonment to him that he had encountered as a child when his family, you know, abandoned him to the care of the Zavarian brothers at St. Mary's Industrial School. So I think there was one of his granddaughters said to me, he was a window wisher, meaning that he would walk by or drive by some house in some city where he'd see a family sitting around a table at dinner talking, and he would wonder, why didn't I have that? And so he made baseball his family. He made all those boys who clung to him his family. And when it was gone, he really didn't know how to be. And you asked about the difference between him and Koufax and Mantle. I would say that was the biggest difference. Koufax is somebody who knew who he was with or without a baseball uniform on. I don't think Babe Ruth really did.
The big fella, Babe Ruth, of the world he created. Jane Levy, thank you so much for talking with us. Love the book and appreciate you carving out a little time this afternoon to chat with us about this wonderful read.
Thanks so much, Rich. It's a pleasure. Happy holidays, everybody.